So I spent a couple of weeks, I think it was 2.5 weeks in Venezuela in the December of 2002, January of 2003, which if people remember was during the time when the lockout happened. It was called a strike. In the media here, it was not a strike. The bosses essentially locked out the workers in Venezuela. And so it was a really, really important time to be there. And we went down to see what was going on because you don't get a whole lot of information. You get more now, but particularly at that time, you did not get a whole lot of real information coming out of Venezuela to the population in the U.S. So we went down there, and it was an amazing 2 weeks, a really amazing 2 weeks. And I wanted to just share a little bit about it and then go into an analysis of what's going on in Venezuela and some more information and update. But one of the really amazing things is that the constitution in Venezuela, you can get it everywhere. And it's about this big and about that thick, and it's blue. And every person on the street has one in their back pocket. And it doesn't just sit in the back pocket. They like pick it out and they'll thumb through it and be like, look at this, look at Section 8, Article 18, this is what it says and this is what it does. And that was a really shocking thing for me because how many people have a U.S. Constitution in their back pocket? Or even at home or anywhere? Jack, but no one else, I'm sure. I don't, I never did. And the reason that's so incredible is not just to compare it to the U.S., but because the process that's going on in Venezuela is exactly that. People are taking the laws, the reforms, and they're becoming their own. And they own them. They know them. They know the Constitution, which is one of the most progressive constitutions in the hemisphere and maybe the world. But it's very, very progressive, and it was put together by the people themselves in a fashion. There were other things. We spent Christmas Eve defending PDVSA, which is the oil corporation. We spent the entire night on the corner next to it, having a rally about defending the oil, which has been a national resource since 72. I'll talk more about that later, but even though it was nationalized, it was designed not really to be nationalized, and not until the last 2 years has it actually been something that is given to the people of Venezuela. So it was incredible, and I urge anyone who can to read about personal experiences and to go to Venezuela if you can. There is a delegation this August for the World Festival of Youth and Students, which I'm going to be going on. But really, what we have to have in the U.S. is a clear analysis of what's going on in Venezuela, because if we're going to be in solidarity with Venezuela and the people of Venezuela, we need to understand what's going on and the process, which has evolved since it really started in I'm going to say 89. We can argue about that, but I'll talk about that as well. But so the process in Venezuela, the revolutionary process, which they call there the Bolivarian Revolution, has gone through three pretty distinct phases. If you look at what's going on, it's gone through a political phase, and then a social phase, and an economic phase. And those aren't like distinct intellectual words that are meant to sort of box it up, but just to give a sense of the evolution of this process. And the political phase started in 98 when Hugo Chavez was elected to the presidency with a huge percentage of the vote. And he immediately called a constituent assembly, which was put together from all different sectors of society. There were women who participated in a women's caucus. There were indigenous people who came in. There were LGBT folks. All these different people came together in this constituent assembly to rewrite the Constitution of Venezuela, which in a lot of ways resembled ours before this point. And so that constitution was then put up for a referenda, which received 60% majority and was approved. And that's when it became the most progressive constitution in the hemisphere. And that, in addition to a lot of other things, began this political transformation that went on in Venezuela. There were hundreds of laws enacted. There was the law of fisheries, which gave small fishermen more space to fish, to push the multinational corporations back. There was the land reform. There was a lot of different laws and institutions set up, like the Bank of the Women, or the Women's Bank, rather. But these things weren't really implemented. They were made, they were put out there. It was a very important process. But it wasn't until the coup that I'm sure everyone knows about, April 11th of 2002, where the people of Venezuela really took the process as their own and really said, this is ours and we will defend it with our lives, which they did. So when Chavez was kidnapped and taken to a small island next to Venezuela, they came out in full force. And it was really incredible. I know it was incredible just to read about it, but when you go to Venezuela, they show you the bridge where people were defending you know, all the different territory they'd gotten. They take you to the different places that are now like monuments for them, because they really came out, and they came out from, it's hard to imagine, but Caracas is most of the poor people live outside of the city, on the hills, on what they call urbanizations, which they essentially built themselves. Like most of the places where they live, they just sort of built up. So they came down miles and miles and miles to defend Chavez and defend the process, and it was really, really exciting. And that's when most of these political things could begin to be implemented, and that sort of started this new phase for the Venezuelan people, a social phase of really changing the social conditions that people lived in. And before that point, 80% of people in Venezuela lived in poverty. So it was a huge thing to start talking about education, healthcare, all of these different things. And that's this social phase, the implementation of political phase. And one of the things they did was they instituted missions. And there's all these different missions, the Robinson Mission, the Sucre Mission, I have to look them up, the Barrio Dentro, all these different ones. And what I want to talk about within the missions in particular is the relationship to Cuba that was built through these missions, because the Cubans really supported the social work that was going on, and Mission Robinson in particular was designed by a Cuban professor who had participated in and led the literacy campaigns in Cuba itself. And it was really designed to wipe out illiteracy, which wasn't that high in Venezuela as it was in Cuba in 1959. It wasn't that high, but people didn't have a very high level of education. So a lot of people could read, they were literate, but only about 5% had actually graduated from high school. So it was this attempt to get people into the classrooms, and you'll see more in the video, like these people talking about what it means to be able to read, to go through these things. And these were also combined with not only teaching education, but healthcare. There are over 13,000 Cuban doctors working in places that have never had healthcare in Venezuela. They go right into the barrios. They go with a group of Venezuelans, and they set up in someone's home. And people come, and they get free medical care, and they get free preventative care. It's not just, okay, you're sick, we'll take care of you. It's like, what kind of lifestyle do you lead? How much exercise do you get? Do you smoke? All of these different things they go through, and it's a real process of increasing the health of the entire population. And it's in the neighborhood. They don't have to leave their neighborhood to get it. So those are two of the more out front ones. But there are ones to get people to go back to work, to get people into college. The Bolivar and University of Venezuela was started and now enrolls 400,000 students who never before had access to university education. And this plays a huge role in the continued development of the process, because people feel that it's theirs, know how to articulate what's going on, and be more and more involved in it. When we were there, we went to a cooperative, which was one of the things set up to provide people jobs. And it was in this barrio, and they had this saying, I'm trying to think, it's, we used to have more bullets to eat than food, which is what the saying was for this place. And they had organized two cooperatives, all on their own. They had said this. They said, no one came to us and told us to organize these. We saw the resources were being available. We went and we get them. And what they do, the two different ones, one in particular, which is the largest, they clean up the neighborhood park. But they've designed it so that the people come there, they meet in this little meeting house where all the tools are kept, and they receive the resources for this. And while they're there, before they work and after they work, they have political education. There was a mother there, she was 23, she had three kids, and she was getting her high school diploma as part of this cooperative at the park that they were cleaning up. So it's a very inspiring process to see these missions in action. The third phase that I want to talk about that came after this is an economic phase. And I don't know if people have seen the news, but these microphones are kind of funny because there's this picture of Chavez on May Day with, like, he looks like he's eating two microphones and he's really just like this, and there's socialismo is above his head, or socialism. And this process, this economic process, was when the land reform was really instituted. And they took back a British farm and they said, this land is idle, the Constitution gives us the right, and this is going to the poor farmers and peasants. And that's part of the whole process that has come under different names. Chavez and José Vicente Rangel, who is the vice president, used the word endogenous development at first, which just meant developing from within, protecting our national sovereignty, which is a big thing for Venezuela. Although it's very wealthy in terms of its resources, it was importing up to 60% of its food. So just beginning to produce its own food and use its own food instead of importing food is a big deal for Venezuela. So that's part of it. Also, there have been two industries that have been nationalized in the last year. And this is really important because it's not that the administration has said, okay, we're going to nationalize these industries. They've nationalized them in the response to the very strong movement of the workers who have said, this is our industry, we work it, they've taken it over. And in terms of Venepal, which was just nationalized, the workers took it over twice. They took it over, it was taken back by the bosses, they took it over again and said, no, we're going to use this to help the Bolivarian process, to help the revolution. And they did, and it's now a national industry of Venezuela. I think it's called, I can't remember the whole name, it's really long. But and they said, and if you listen to what they say or you read that they say, it says things like, so now we're producing, there's no waste. Before, the industry was in the red. And now they're actually producing, they're turning a profit, and they're proposing that these missions be brought right into the industry. So they're saying, we have land over here, let's start the healthcare right here for the workers and their families. Let's start the school, we can donate this land now. So it's a very exciting process. But the really important thing about that is that it's not a movement being led just by the Chavez administration or anything like that. It's really from the demands of the workers and poor of Venezuela that have become even more militant than Chavez or Rangel or others and have become demanding these things for themselves and taking them. So that's important. So that's the sort of people's role in the movement. And it has other forms. I wrote an article recently, and I'm not going to talk a whole lot about it, but about the workers' movement and the organized workers' movement, because the coup that happened in April of 2002, there were three main forces that participated in it. One was Fede Cámaras, which is the bosses, basically. It's like the Chamber of Commerce, but a little more powerful. The media, and the CTV, which is the trade worker federation in Venezuela, which has been very, very corrupt, and which has lost more and more of its potential. And so, in response to their participation in the coup, union organizers within the CTV, which had been organizing previously to move it to the left, to make it more militant, to make it open to the workers, and not being allied with the bosses, they broke away from it and started the UNT, or the UNT, and which is a new federation that now has more than 1 million workers. Because the workers, like the workers of Venepal, who were not organized, said, we want them to organize us. We want you to represent us. And that has been happening all over. In the last 2 years, there's been 23 union referenda, which is in a plant where both federations say they have some representation or whatever. The workers are given a referenda, and the workers have 21 out of those 23 times voted for the UNT and said, we want this new, more militant Chavista representation. And it's very exciting, and there's a whole lot of things going on there, and I urge you to read the article or look more into it. But that's sort of some of the exciting developments that have happened with the people themselves who have become more organized and more militant and really defending the process themselves. The title tonight was Resisting the Empire, and I want to talk about that because that's really why it's so important for us in the United States to have solidarity with the struggle in Venezuela, because the empire is here. The center of it is here, and the threats against Venezuela, the attacks on Venezuela are coming from here. And the U.S. has played a really large role in what's going on, and I want to talk about that a little bit. So in the beginning, the U.S. really just supported the opposition, which has been different people, but it's basically the elite in Venezuela. It's the upper class, it's the media, it's the oil bosses, it's the different banks, corporations that operate there who were virulently against these reforms because it took away the control, the power they had over the resources in Venezuela. And the U.S. was, and really helped them. If you look up like the National Endowment for Democracy gave a lot of money to the people who were the faces of the coup, to Ortega and Carmona. And the U.S., that's pretty much failed. The opposition, although it continues to be a threat, has tried two lockouts, it's tried referendums, it's tried the coup, it's tried anything it could really find to hold back the revolutionary process, to pull them back. And it's not really working partly because the opposition itself is fractured and constantly fights among itself and splits up, and partly, too, because the strength of the Venezuelan people has just increased and increased and increased. So the U.S. has turned in the last couple months to a more direct threats and a more direct attacks on Venezuela, not in terms of military, like the possibility of an invasion hasn't really been discussed, but rather they're trying to characterize Venezuela and Chavez in particular as this authoritarian democracy, which is, I don't even know. But they're trying to make this distinction between being democratically elected and democratically governing, which for some reason they feel they have the right to make that distinction. Exactly, like any country the U.S. feels strongly about. But what this was a preparation for the OAS meetings, the Organization of American States, that just finished, actually. And there are a lot of different comments made. Condoleezza Rice, in particular, has kind of been in the face of these threats, saying that Chavez governs in an illiberal way, or all these just different ridiculous things. And the interesting thing about this is that Venezuela has never backed down from any of these struggles. They have continued to show solidarity with all of the anti-imperialist struggles around the country. For instance, before the war in Iraq, Chavez went to Iraq. He's been to Iran. They have a very good relationship with Cuba and have refused to sever that relationship. They recently bought 100,000 rifles from Russia in an attempt to increase their military power, to renovate their military, and they have a new strategy as well. That's something I should talk about. The Venezuelans did announce in the last 6 months a new military strategy. So they moved the Bolivarian University to the barracks of the military to directly connect that education about the process and the defense of that process. So there's a new military strategy going on, and part of that was talking to Russia and making this deal with Russia, which the U.S. was very, very against, and tried to intervene and tried to stop Russia and tried to stop Venezuela from completing this contract, which they'd made last October. But both of those went forward with the contract, both Russia and Venezuela. And also with Brazil and with the Bolivarian Alternative for Latin America, which is an economic alternative. It's an economic agreement among Latin American countries. These are all things that have been thoroughly anti-imperialist in Venezuela, saying, no, the U.S. cannot tell Latin America how to live, how to do our economic trade, how to do any of the things we do, which has been U.S. policy since 1823, since the Monroe Doctrine. So they've been thoroughly anti-imperialist, and in the OAS meeting, the U.S. lost again. They set forward this, essentially what they want the OAS to do is use a democratic charter, which was written in 1991, to say that if countries in Latin America aren't democratic, the OAS can intervene. So that's the importance of the authoritarian democracy. They're trying to say, no, this isn't a democracy. The OAS needs to intervene. And the Caribbean countries and the South American countries thoroughly renounced that. And they didn't get through what they wanted to get through in the OAS. So that continues to sort of pose this threat that the U.S. has towards Venezuela, because they have a lot of options, and they're sort of, I think, trying to figure out what to do after this OAS defeat, which really was a defeat, and there's been many other defeats. So I'm trying to... Oh, the other thing that I wanted to talk about, and actually this is probably the end of my speech, is the Posada Carriles case, which we discussed at the beginning. This is really important, because Posada is a Venezuelan. He has dual citizenship, both in Venezuela and in Cuba. And Cuba felt that it could not ask for the extradition of Posada to Cuba because of the relationship between the U.S. and Cuba. And Venezuela has asked for his extradition, which they have a right to do. There's evidence that he planned the bombing, the Cubana bombing in Venezuela. They have evidence of that. He was arrested and imprisoned in Venezuela. And evidence of his other crimes, which are many. It's not just the Cubana bombing. There's very many. And so they've asked for this extradition, and it's become a point of contention between the U.S. and Venezuela. And 2 weeks ago on Alo Presidente, which is Chavez's weekly radio address, which is where he shares what's going on, and they really have these conversations on the television about what's going on in the process, he said, if we have to break diplomatic relations with the U.S., we'll do it. Posada should be extradited to the United States. So this has become the biggest point. to Venezuela. Sorry. And then he did it again this week. He said the same thing. He said, we do not need our relationship with the United States. We would like it. But if they're not going to extradite Posada to Venezuela, as is legally they legally should, then we don't need to have relationship with them. Which is bigger than just the Posada case itself. I mean, it's very important for a country that has been so anti-imperialist and has so much social upheaval going on and so many different things going on to say, no, we don't need you. We don't need the U.S. And so that's a big development, and we have to see where that goes because it just happened. But it poses a threat to the United States, and the United States has to figure out what to do. And I think the thing about Venezuela that is similar in some ways into the other relations that U.S. has gotten itself in, like with Iraq, is that the U.S. doesn't really want to give Venezuela up. It's not like it can say, oh, well, we just want to end relations and that's it, you know, that's fine. Venezuela is very important in a lot of things that the U.S. wants to do in Latin America as a whole. In addition to being a huge supplier of oil to the United States, and there are a lot of U.S. corporations in Venezuela, it has a strategic geographic position at the top of South America, where the U.S. wants to institute this FTAA, the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas. And so Venezuela being another Cuba, as they put it, or another obstacle to this, would be a huge threat to the U.S. hegemony in the entire region. So I think, just to end up and then I'll introduce the video, is that with this going on, it's very important for us to have these discussions and to continue. But it's more important for us to be in the streets and to be in solidarity with the people of Venezuela and to say these things to the people we know. Because if you talk to people, they really don't know what's going on. I had to convince my grandmother that Chavez wasn't a dictator and he wasn't this and that. You know, I mean, I think that we need to continue to talk to people and we need to be out on September 24th, not just for Venezuela, for Iraq and Palestine. But that's the most important show of solidarity that we can do with the Venezuelan people, in addition to delegations and support and things like that, is really being in the streets. So I'd like to encourage everyone.